Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about historical or intergenerational trauma. The theory of historical trauma was developed in the 1980s by Native American social worker and mental health expert Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart to explain a whole constellation of symptoms a family, a community, or a people experience in reaction to traumatic events. Sister Catherine Baltazar, who works as a psychiatric nurse practitioner on a reservation at a hospital in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, says, "We deal with the repercussions of it. You're seeing it in the substance abuse and in depression and anxiety. When somebody comes in to see me, it's because of the depression or the anxiety, the sleeplessness. But if you dig deep enough, it comes back to what they are now doing to themselves was done unto them." For many European Americans, though, this idea is counterintuitive. Accustomed to the idea of bootstrapping oneself out of any difficulty in life and having more often been perpetrators of historical trauma as opposed to the objects of it, they're more inclined to meet the theory with a scornful "get over it." But according to an article this month at Aussie.com, quote, "It's been scientifically proven that survivors of Canada's residential schools can't just get over the experience because it's in their genes. Recent studies on the science behind intergenerational trauma have discovered that trauma can be passed between generations. Chemical tags acting like post-its can latch onto our DNA, switching genes off and on. A research team at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital, led by Rachel Yehuda, a leading expert on post-traumatic stress and epigenetics, concluded that some of these tags could be transferred across generations. Our guests this evening include a member of the local Native American community, the African American community, and the Jewish community, all populations who have been affected by historical trauma in one way or another and are still struggling to understand it, how it manifests itself, and where they go from here. Let's meet our guests.
I am Deborah Peterson-Perlman. I'm the chair of the Balmer Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, and I've been studying the Holocaust for about 20 years. And the issue of historical trauma is not one that I've specifically looked at, but of course it pervades the discipline. I mean, it's something that is there in the stories and the analyses, the narratives. So it's something that I'm certainly familiar with from that perspective.
Hello, my name is Jeremy Neville Sorrell, and I work with Mending the Sacred Hoop, and we do domestic violence and sexual assault training and technical assistance, helping people develop programs and responses and do community education and awareness around violence against women issues. And the issue of historical trauma is a big one around violence in our communities because we are close enough to our traditions in the past since the colonization of the Americas that we know what these practices are and know what our communities look like from the past, and then that influence since this time of colonization and what that brought and the violence that we have seen the change. And a lot of communities, it's within a couple lifetimes. So it's a really big issue, and it brings a big problem to how we organize today because of the acculturation and what we see as cultural norms and relationships and values and integration and people leaving reservations and being more in urban areas versus in more isolated areas on reservations. So it has very very different impacts depending on where you were, isolated rural areas to urban areas. And so it's a complex issue that we have to deal with.
I am Kim Young. I am a community human rights activist here in the Twin Ports. And we are now really, really dealing with and trying to formulate some answers to the generational trauma that has been ongoing in the African heritage communities in our country. And we're seeing the culmination of the effects of that in the increased violence that is happening to Black bodies in the communities, and also dealing with issues of mental health and violence against women, violence against our Black LGBTQ community members, against our children, generational trauma that is seriously affecting our children now, as they are also dealing with increased levels of racism in the schools. And it's something that is very ongoingly traumatic, I want to say, because I myself am dealing with those issues right now. And as our people are awakening to what we need to do to eradicate racism, who we need to work with, and calling on our allies to become accomplices, working with the Native American community, Hispanic communities, the LGBTQ community, dealing with the intersectionality that goes along with these traumas, we are seeing that we have a whole lot of work to do, a lot of issues to be dealt with within our community, as well as dealing with those connections that are spreading out to other communities as well. So what I'm going to try to bring to the conversation today is my experiences with those from my past as a domestic violence advocate, as a community advocate now, and also as an activist in the community organizing for change.
People are becoming more and more conversant with the idea of generational or historic trauma. But I think for each of you to summarize the trauma itself that we're talking about and how it's manifesting itself today.
In terms of the Holocaust, I think that the trauma, of course, is a reflection of the experience of Jews under Nazi rule and in the camps and in the ghettos. And the manifestation is a form of PTSD often, although not exclusively, among the subsequent generations. And I myself am not a member of a family that had survivors from the Holocaust, but I've read about it. So I can't speak as a somebody who's experienced this myself. All I can speak of is what I've read. And I want to be very clear about that. I don't feel expert in any way, shape, or form. But I think one of the things that I found most interesting and poignant is in the post-war era, when survivors were clustered in DP camps that were, you know, just a notch or two above the concentration camps themselves, the impetus was, we have to form relationships, we have to marry, we have to procreate, we have to replace those who were lost in the Holocaust. That notion of replacement, I think, had its own set of ramifications throughout generations. It's important, however, and I think, you know, my colleagues will probably echo this, that, you know, not all survivors had the same experience. So, you know, intergenerational trauma is not something that is universal at all. But, you know, there are enough examples of situations where the trauma is recognizable and now studyable, and people have categorized it in various ways.
It's a friendly sounding term, historical trauma versus historical institutionalized oppression. And that's really what a lot of the communities are dealing with, is generational after generations of having to deal with oppression and survive within it. And so when you're confined within walls or have these barriers, you figure out ways to navigate through it. And like, you know, like individually, we have people who don't show the challenges and the traumas and like symptoms, like you're saying, PTSD and things like that. But as a people, we learn how to navigate. And we always talk about, as Native people, walking in two worlds. So we have to walk in this world, mainstream society, culture, interact with all groups, and then we have to be a different way within our own group. But the impact of that oppression shapes the way we view ourselves, each other, and how we interact with other people. And the challenges internally that happens because of that feeling of having to go through all this is how a culture develops in response to all of that oppression and all of that violence. So you become a little more hypervigilant around strangers. You become a little bit more recluse and not inviting people into your communities. There's certain ceremonies that people can't come to. And way back when, our ceremonies were wide open. It was for the community. Talking with elders and people who still, you know, I'm not a language speaker of Ojibwe, but when we talk about the meaning of Ojibwe people, people think of it as a term that refers to the people of the land, or it's something, you know, related to that. But then one of our speakers was breaking it down, and when you break down each syllable has its own meaning, and it actually translates to be a spirit breathing. And so when you're saying, our traditions say to live as Ojibwe, it isn't to be an Indian person from Minnesota. It's to live as a spirit breathing, and you're supposed to treat other people as Ojibwe people. So really, our teaching is about being a human to another human, no matter where you're from. But over time, because of that loss and the impact of that colonization, now it's just kind of reverted back to who are we as Indian people versus non-Indian people. And that willingness for a lot of people, because of the oppression, is not to welcome that and not to be inviting. And that's when you get the tensions across races and urban areas, the tensions between Blacks and Natives growing up in Minneapolis, where I'm from. It was huge. I mean, I knew the social structure as a kid. You know, I'm mixed. My dad's Black and white, my mom's Native. So I used to call myself Neapolitan, you know, just as a way to avoid dealing with race issues. But going to school, I knew the hierarchy in school. It was Whites, Blacks, and Indians. And I was really glad when all the Hmong immigrants came in town, because there was someone else for other people to pick on, you know, and that was in second grade. So I knew that already by second grade, and already I knew how to avoid the conversation about my identity and who I was in order to fit in. And, you know, and that's what we really got to deal with. You know, we deal with those internal struggles. And then now as an adult, it's about sharing that awareness with people and really talking about why it is we do things the way that we do. And the topic of historical trauma can be misleading to people who are just new to it, because when they think of trauma, they think of the individual itself and want to change and heal the person, but not deal with the systematic issues. And that's a big issue. We got to look at the systematic issues.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about historical trauma this evening, and our guests in the studio are Deborah Peterson-Perlman, chair of the Baumler-Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, Jeremy Neville Sorrell of Mending the Sacred Hoop, an organization that works around issues of domestic violence and violence against women in Native communities, and Kim Young, community and human rights activist in the African Heritage Community here in the Twin Ports.
For my experience as an African-American woman who has Native lineage, it was a little different growing up, because our situation was White, Native, Black. We were at the bottom because I grew up down south. So it was very different. And Cherokee Heritage was very big and very welcome in the African Heritage community. As I moved up north, I noticed a change, and it was very prominent. But I feel myself very fortunate that I was welcomed into the community with my Native sisters and Native brothers that I got to know. For us, similar circumstances, we have masks that we wear when we walk into the community, when we walk out of our homes. It's like we keep a mask by the door that we have to put on, because we have to act white in a world where we know we will never fit in because of the color of our skin. So that generational trauma right there is something that is passed on every family daily. You have a conversation with your children. How do you act when you walk out this door? How do you act when you go to school? How do you talk to people? There was a great deal of forced respect towards police officers that was taught to us as children, because down south, we knew police contact could be life-threatening. So that's always been an issue for us. Businesses, dealing with people on a day-to-day basis, it's always front and center in your mind that you are Black, that you have no place really in the society, that you are tolerated to a point. And I say tolerated to a point because as long as you act white, but you keep your place and know your place, you're okay. And always underlining that was that issue of you're not really welcome in this country. You don't belong because we have no connection basically to the land. This was not our land. We were placed here, taken away from our culture, taken away from our history, taken away from who we as a people were. They took our language from us. They took our gods from us. Everything was taken from us. And we were imposed upon with something that was alien and new. How do you explain that in this day and age to children and to people who grew up in the church, which is, you know, a faith-based support system for dealing with this intergenerational trauma, but at the same time recognizing now that what we were told was a lie told to control us. So we're dealing with that issue. We're dealing with the issue of awakening. We're dealing with traumas within us that are divisionary in and among themselves, stereotypes that we have taken to heart so much so that we're fighting those down among ourselves. So in essence, working through the generational traumas is not just dealing with PTSD, not just dealing with generational issues of obesity and diabetes and heart disease and issues of non-inclusivity, but also dealing with divisions among ourselves regarding the stereotypes, regarding how we look at each other, how we deal with each other, how our men are seen as a little bit less than our women, and our women are not disrespected, are not respected, but objectified sexually. So it's a conundrum for us right now.
With what I've learned and what I have tried to explain to other people, either it's seen as whining, get over it, and there's an eye roll, or if it didn't happen to you, what's the issue? So as you go out into communities, and this is a reaction that you get, how do you explain to people? How do you can make a connection to people so that they can understand?
Can I start this off? When people start, and I know exactly which group of people you're talking about, my response to them is, okay, but you turned into one of the enslavers when you came to this country. You turned into one of the oppressors when you came to this country because your people owned my people in the South. And then they stop and they look at you and think about it and they say, yeah. Now, the difference of that being, we never became the oppressor. We never became the owners. And in fact, in some situations, we're still seen as property. When you look at the for-profit prison in industrial complex, we're still seen as the product that is either going to cull it and get out the bad ones, or you're going to comply and become one of the useful ones. And that's just it. That's all we're seen as. We're not seen as complete entities that are integrated into this country. Having those conversations after that get real difficult because you have to get people to understand the fact that they're privileged, the fact that they've never, ever, and never will understand what it's like to be Black, brown, or native in this country, and what it was like to be under imperialistic colonial rule, what it was like to have everything stripped from you, and what was able to be salvaged of our cultures is being spoon-fed back to us by those who remember, those who survived the boarding schools, those who survived Jim Crow era, those who survived the Great Migrations, both North and South again, and now those of us who are reigniting the modern civil rights movement.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about historical trauma this evening, and our guests in the studio are Deborah Peterson-Perlman,
chair of the Baumler-Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee. Jeremy Neville Sorrell of Mending the Sacred Hoop, an organization that works around issues of domestic violence and violence against women in Native communities. And Kim Young, community and human rights activist in the African Heritage Community here in the Twin Ports.
I guess one of the things I thought of in response to your question was the silence that was so pervasive following World War II. People didn't want to hear about the camps. They didn't want to think of themselves as victims, particularly in the Jewish community. And so there was a resentment towards survivors in some respects. And they were silenced, and that silence was so damaging. And I think contributed to trauma, exacerbated trauma. I think that, you know, we talk about different eras in Holocaust studies, and really the first period where it became seriously acceptable to talk about the Holocaust was in the 1980s. There had been a little bit in the immediate post-war era. Then, of course, we had the Anne Frank phenomenon, where everybody identified Anne Frank as the representation of the Holocaust. But everybody else's voice was silenced and squashed. In the literature that I've reviewed, one of the things that they talk about is the fact that when you can't talk about these issues, you make them worse. So by opening up the discussion and basically acknowledging the reality of what people who went through the Holocaust experienced, you move toward healing. You move toward at least recognition of what happened. And that recognition can lead to possible solutions.
And in our community, it's important to talk about and use the examples of why it is people are the way they are. We talk about suicide as one of the number one things in Native communities. And I've always said that suicide is an option for, it's a life option. You know, it's not to continue, but it's to end. But it's that common in our communities that people see it as a choice. Do I go to school? Do I get a job? Or do I kill myself? Because that's the reality of the types of oppression and trauma that we're dealing with. And that's rooted back to colonization and the boarding school era, where it is to try to get rid of the Indian people. We couldn't be eradicated through wars, so then the treaties were developed, reservations were developed. You have the same examples as concentration camps, internment camps for Japanese, all this other stuff that's the same part of it. It's the whole pattern. And so having conversations with groups outside of our Native communities with other people helps bring that example of bringing it to light. So look at the patterns that happen over and over around any type of area that's been colonized, no matter where you're at across the globe. It's got the same types of patterns that go on. And people being isolated. In the boarding school, you have the pictures of Native children going in, and you were removed from your home, sometimes forcibly. Sometimes it was you were withheld provisions. You wouldn't get food or medicine or clothing or anything like that. There was all types of coercion going on to get the kids into the schools, the boarding schools, and basically it was trade jobs and kind of like that house servants type of work. And in those boarding schools, some were run by churches, some were run by military, but there was a lot of physical and sexual abuse that happened. You could not speak your language, and if you're a 4 or 5 year old kid, you don't know English, and every time you spoke your language, you were hit, and so you didn't know what was going on. And so can you imagine that? And then after kids grew up in that, and then they went back into our communities, that's what they learned. So they weren't being taught the traditions and values that we know to have existed, and were not taught how to live with family and community and have that extended family network. They were bringing back what they learned from those outside places in. So you didn't know how to parent. You didn't have interpersonal skills. You didn't have that same type of connection. And then at the same time, you were alienated from within your own community because you were then different. So you create this person then who doesn't feel exactly whole person and feels conflicted. And then you start to perpetrate that same violence in your own community. And then dealing with your own stuff, you get the alcoholism. And nowadays, you just drugs and everything else. And it's over and over and over. And that's why you see a lot of that going on, a lot of the violence, a lot of the alcohol issues, a lot of the health issues, because our diets then are now different. It's now commodity foods, processed foods. And so we get health issues that are really bad. And then we got the hopelessness from all of that. Because what do you see in the future for your community with all of this that's happening?
Where is the energy in communities now? Is it being spent recovering, or is it being spent trying to get the rest of the world to take historical or generational trauma seriously? And can you recover, can you heal without acknowledgement from the perpetrators?
In our community, it's the new generation that needs to learn all the time, like what's happening to them. It's like anyone learning to walk, ride a bike, drive a car, balance a checkbook. Everyone in their life has to learn that at some point in time. So we can't pick up people and fast forward them to it. Like everyone has to go through that challenge. So when we, you're talking about, Kim, the example of like, you know, we thought things were done and taken care of in the 60s, 70s. Well, there is that new generation, the millennials, who have to learn that what had happened and have to experience that and get that knowledge and information. Like we still have to teach each generation coming up. That's why education, the school systems, those, we just can't default to the same three idols, your same leaders all over the place. We have to continually teach that new generation and get people once again having good dialogue. And I think that's the biggest thing, internally and externally, because we talk about internalized oppression. So there's external and the internal, where we adopt that belief and perpetrate that within on ourselves and to our members of our own community. And if we're not having conversations to understand where it's come from, where it's rooted, and where we picked up these beliefs and values, and have an opportunity to change, we could talk about it and be angry about it, and we can do that a lot. That's real easy to be angry about it, but then what do you do about it? That's the hard part, and that's where the discussion needs to come in.
In our community, there was a loss of respect for our elders, because it seemed like our elders dropped the ball. At some point after the civil rights movement, it got to a point of complacency and comfort. And we were being taught that with hard work and diligence, you can get to this place of comfort and it's all going to be better. And it wasn't, because we had ghettos that were filling up at that time, housing projects, and people weren't able to get out. The ways we were taught to get out were through sports. You know, education was okay, but then the education system started to fail our children. So then what takes the place of that? Well, then you got cops in schools and you got the school to prison pipeline, which is still failing our children. So we have this group of millennials who grew up in the post-civil rights era of the 60s, and they were, you know, pushed towards drugs, pushed towards, you know, the gang violence that was happening in Los Angeles and New York and in Chicago. And now we've got this division among ourselves regarding four block territories. Okay. Then you've got people from the South who are coming up who are really, really strong on education and the historically black colleges and universities. And you come North, and that's where we're finding that we're learning our history. We're learning our culture, because it wasn't being taught to us in the schools in the South. And you come North and learn more about what's going on. You learn the real intent of Dr. Martin Luther King, the real intent of Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and what was going on, and things that was being rediscovered by the millennials. Okay, so now you've got this. We've got an awakened, aware youth movement going on, but at the same time, we've got these complacently set, comfortable elders who don't want to give up power.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. We'd like to thank our guests this evening, Deborah Peterson-Perlman chair of the Baumler-Kaplan Holocaust Commemoration Committee, Jeremy Neville Sorrell of Mending the Sacred Hoop, an organization that works around issues of domestic violence and violence against women in Native communities, and Kim Young, community and human rights activist in the African Heritage Community here in the Twin Ports. Next month, on September 5th, we'll bring you the second part of this fascinating conversation about historical trauma and how three different groups of people right here in the Twin Ports are being affected by it and coming to terms with it. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.